Good afternoon or good evening. I'm very sorry we're a little late. You know, at the Centre Study Human Rights, we like to start everything on time. One of us forgot our glasses on the way here. We just arrived, and then one of us forgot we hadn't got our spectacles. And though we could read, we couldn't see any of the people who asked questions. So one of us is responsible for this. And I wouldn't, as a host, I will of course not allocate responsibility in any way, but nor will I take it. We are really delighted to see so many of you, and I can see the top is packed as well as the bottom here in the Old Theatre to continue our series of events, which this academic year have included inviting people from the key non-government organisations within the country. And we had Irene Khan, as you know, speak brilliantly on Human Rights Day here. And picking up on this theme of involving the NGOs in our work, we are delighted to have this evening Shami Chakrabarty, who's the director of Liberty. Liberty used to be called the National Council for Civil Liberties. It started in the 1930s. It is one of the oldest and most enduring, as well as the most effective civil rights or civil liberties or liberty organizations in the United Kingdom, if not the most effective. Shami's background for this post is relatively unusual, having worked for a number of years in the Home Office as a legal advisor, 5.5 years. And so she brings to the job not only an awareness of civil liberties from an NGO perspective, but also from a government perspective, and therefore has a wealth of experience in the field. And we are, kind of say again, extremely delighted, indeed privileged, that she's chosen to accept our invitation and to speak as a relatively new member of our director of Liberty on the subject Freedom in Blair's Britain. Shami, over to you.
The choice for mankind lay between freedom and happiness. And for the great bulk of mankind, happiness was better. The party was the eternal guardian of the weak, a dedicated sect doing evil that good might come, sacrificing its own happiness to that of others. So wrote Mr. Blair. Not, I hasten to add, our Prime Minister, but another famous Blair, Eric Arthur Blair, a.k.a. George Orwell, in chapter 3 of his most chilling and famous work, 1984. Last summer, nearly 20 years beyond the projected doomsday of Orwell's totalitarian fantasy, Prime Minister Blair addressed the United States Congress in rather more inspirational tones. The spread of freedom is the best security for the free. It is our last line of defense and our first line of attack. And just as the terrorist seeks to divide humanity in hate, so we have to unify it around an idea. And that idea is liberty. The liberty we seek is not for some but for all, for that is the only true path to victory in this struggle. A few days later, I received the greatest and most daunting honour of being appointed as the 13th person to run Liberty, the National Council for Civil Liberties, and to take this country's leading domestic civil liberties and human rights pressure group into its 70th year. This evening almost exactly marks Liberty's 70th birthday, and I face another daunting honour, that of returning to my old school and to a place of learning, thought and dissent inextricably intertwined with Liberty's own history. The briefest glance at the stories of each institution reveals many names in common. Harold Laski, Bertrand Russell, George Bernard Shaw, to name but a few. I'm glad to say that this close connection continues to this day. I often think of and turn to Connor and Francesca Klug, as the intellectual wing of liberty. Rabinder Singh, now of the law faculty, is one of liberty's most impressive advocates. But enough mitigation as to any discernible stage fright this evening. Why should liberty's work be so hard when our Prime Minister travels the globe to pronounce his passion for freedom? In short, because freedom means such different things to different people, and because since the war against terror, and in truth, at least 10 years before it, there has been in our country a decline in many of the liberal values which should unite all those who love the rule of law, alongside the more progressive or radical disciples of civil liberties and indeed fundamental human rights. Notwithstanding the Human Rights Act and other positive developments in specific areas of home and social policy, for example in the areas of race and gay discrimination, there has been an underlying authoritarian, political and cultural trend which cannot, in my view, ever be addressed by law, lawyers and legislation alone. The tragic events of September the 11th, 2001, my second day of employment at Liberty, didn't begin but helped to accelerate this trend. What is it like then to be the director of Liberty at the height, though who can measure the height, of what could be an unending war against terror? Well, imagine your wildest dream interlaced with a developing nightmare. Perhaps you are a musician, Monke. Imagine the opportunity to make music professionally, but at a time when music is considered frivolous, unnecessary, and possibly even dangerous. Do you play on regardless, the same tunes and arrangements, but to ever-dwindling applause and occasional abuse? When they shut down the concert halls, do you take your music to the street? Do you try to understand the ears of those who find your art naive, atonal, or old-fashioned? Can you popularise your music whilst preserving its beauty and enduring value? All are important questions, but to return to this evening's theme, what do we mean by freedom? Minds far greater than mine have responded to this question for hundreds of years and around the world. Indeed, just a few weeks ago, this very Human Rights Centre discussed fairly focused definitions of civil liberties in the post-9/11 democracy. I don't propose this evening to respond to Connor and Francesca's suggested definitions, but instead to discuss freedom according to the definition seemingly set by the Prime Minister and to some extent the present Home Secretary, Mr. Blunkett. What is their view of freedom? Are they delivering against their own objectives? And if so, at what cost? Even the most cursory examination of relevant speeches and writing by the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary reveals an impatience with traditional civil libertarians, lawyers and judges, when doing traditional judging, that is, rather than adjudicating over political scandal. Traditional ideas of liberty, and indeed legal process, are variously described as anachronistic, elitist, and based upon the most obvious, essentially financial, vested interest. Crucially, traditional values, whether of liberal left or legal establishment, fail to address the concerns of ordinary and disadvantaged people on council estates who would like a little less due process and a little more justice. The Prime Minister's speech at last autumn's Labour Party conference was a good case in point. He acknowledged that a legitimate fear in a 19th century criminal justice system would be that too many innocents be convicted. In a 21st century system, however, the greater fear is of too many of the guilty going free. And heralding the present asylum, open brackets, treatment of claimants, etc., closed brackets, bill, he said, "Changing the law on asylum is the only fair way of helping the genuinely persecuted, and it's the best defence against racism gaining ground. We have cut asylum applications by a half, but we must go further. We should cut back the ludicrously complicated appeal process, derail the gravy train of legal aid, fast track those from democratic countries, and remove those who fail in their claims without further judicial interference. The Home Secretary spoke in similar vein. In the post-Cold War era, the challenges are very different to the past, but no less worrying. I know, and you know, that we cannot win the support for the drive for equality and fairness if people cannot hear our message, because what is happening in their own lives is so frightening, is so uncertain, that they turn away from the more progressive messages. Above all, it seems, the Blairite notion of freedom is one of freedom from fear. Fear of weapons of mass destruction, fear of terrorism, fear of crime, fear of nuisance, antisocial or loutish behaviour, fear of economic migrants or bogus asylum seekers, and the racism which they engender amongst the host population. This freedom from fear stands in stark contrast with outmoded ideas of freedom from state tyranny. On the Blair Blunkett Council estate, fear is of too few rather than too many, of over-timid rather than over-zealous policemen. The enemy is not an essentially benign state that houses you, educates your children, and looks after your elderly relatives. The enemies are your next-door neighbours from hell. On one side, perhaps, drug addicts, predictably engaging in chaotic and petty criminal lifestyles. Their children truant, or have perhaps been excluded from school. In any event, they hang around a lot, playing loud music, or drinking, or worse. This causes you anxiety, not least for your own children, who are basically good kids. On the other side, perhaps, a family of asylum seekers. You see them as a drain on overstretched local services. And aren't some asylum seekers really terrorists? You've never thought of yourself as racist, but you're worried that you and your family are consistently losing out. You want to feel safe. You want a great big CCTV camera and a child curfew order, and your neighbours evicted or convicted or deported before something bad happens. You don't mind that you too will live under the gaze of the camera, or that your children will be subject to the curfew, or that if you are too noisy one summer evening, the first knock on the door may be from a police officer rather than a conventional complaining neighbour. It is a bleak picture indeed. How does a human rights framework sit within it? Well, firstly, we are consistently told, it's time to start concentrating more on the rights of decent, law-abiding citizens, of victims rather than perpetrators or suspected perpetrators of crime. The most important rights on the Blair Blunkett Council estate belong to the non-drug addict, non-asylum seeker family. Secondly, rights, and certainly as far as they extend to our less popular neighbours, come with equal and corresponding responsibilities from which they are indivisible. This is not to be confused with a more conventional post-war analysis of limited, qualified, or even context-sensitive rights. Responsibility here is more than a word for describing the inevitable relationships with our fellow human beings understood and protected within the human rights framework. Further, it is quite different from a convenient way of summing up the legitimate societal objectives for which some rights may proportionately be limited. Put crudely, you abrogate your responsibility, you lose your right. The chaotic, petty criminal family with its nuisance children has long since lost its rights to a home, private or family life. It may also have lost any right to be presumed innocent as to any further allegations of misconduct. Furthermore, in this essentially utilitarian philosophy, it is possible for those who abrogate their responsibilities, or indeed who abuse their rights, to lose them. not only for themselves, but for all those in a similar class. So, whole job lots of asylum seekers are administratively detained, or forced into destitution, or denied access to the highest courts in protection of their human rights, because some are not genuine, or would pursue unmeritorious appeals. Thirdly, it is only the rights of the besieged family, the deserving disadvantaged, that engage any serious obligations on the part of the state. The primary state obligation is to protect the deserving family from its neighbours. However, it is also accepted that the family is entitled to its human dignity and consequent rights in the context of other service provision. The council house in which the family lives should meet some minimum standards. The elderly relative living away in a residential care setting should be treated with appropriate decency. However, the philosophy is slightly less forgiving in the event that such standards ever require legal enforcement, and that drain on the otherwise benign welfare state, legal aid. How then is this view of freedom in society manifest in policy? Firstly, a very great deal of legislation is required. Much of it in some way resorting to criminal or other punitive sanction as a means of seeking to change the behaviour of the few and alleviate the fears of the many. Much of this legislation lies predictably in the criminal justice and immigration and asylum spheres. At least $1 billion a year in the case of criminal law, and about one every other year in the case of asylum. Further, one can discern increasing resort to, for example, criminal sanction or quasi-criminal sanction, a tool virtually invented by New Labour, in areas traditionally considered ripe for social rather than law and order policy. One of the best examples of this phenomenon lies in Mr. Blunkett's first Department of State, the original flagship of the New Labour government, education. In 1999, the then Education Secretary was particularly concerned about levels of truancy in Britain's schools. It may be extremely difficult to legislate for interested pupils, engaged parents, and inspirational teachers, but criminal offences, especially those likely to remain a dead letter, are easy and relatively cheap. Section 444 of the Education Act 1996 already provided a criminal offence committed by parents who failed to secure the regular school attendance of their children. The offence was one of strict liability. No guilty intention or even knowledge was required on the part of the parent perpetrators. The offence might be committed by a busy working parent who packed a child's lunch each day and waved him off to school in the positive belief that school was his certain destination. It might even, therefore, be committed by the deserving, disadvantaged parent. However, the tradition was that offences of strict liability, though necessary and justified in many regulatory contexts, should not attract imprisonment. So the original Section 444 attracted a fine only. Mr. Blunkett boarded the Criminal Justice and Court Services Bill of the then Home Secretary, Jack Straw. He boarded it with a clause amending the original penalty to one allowing for up to 3 months' imprisonment. Imagine the scenario. A single parent struggles to make ends meet and to care for the child or children. A child persistently truants. The school and education authority contact the parent who fails to solve the problem. The state intervenes to protect the truanting child by prosecuting and imprisoning the parent, with the likely consequence that the child is taken into care. It was, I think, little surprise when this one clause in a bill of 82 clauses and 8 schedules caused such consternation in both Houses of Parliament. Indeed, the whole bill might have been lost in the House of Lords had the clause not been amended to attach imprisonment only to a new discrete aggravated offence involving knowledge of the truancy and a lack of reasonable justification. Still, however, one wonders how many children's educations were really saved or enriched as a result. Secondly, one can observe the modernisation of traditional due process or principles of legal procedural fairness, and a constant blurring of outmoded distinctions between criminal, civil and administrative legal systems. There are umpteen examples of this phenomenon in Blair's Britain. The so-called rebalancing of the criminal justice system calls into question traditional notions about how to tip the scales, about the need to protect the accused and the presumption of his innocence within an adversarial courtroom setting, less advanced disclosure to the accused and more to the prosecution, wider admissibility of an accused's previous convictions, and so on. A now well-worn formulation of civil order, aimed at the antisocial, the football hooligan, the past sex offender, and so on, allows criminal sanction upon breach, a sort of bespoke criminal offence designed by a magistrate to deal with the particular risk and conduct presented by an individual. Philosophically, one might argue that these are little different from traditional injunctions. However, state actors, rather than irritated neighbours, apply for these orders. Increasingly, they are accompanied by policies of naming and shaming, including on occasion in the case of minors, by the police. Predictably, however, it is in the area of anti-terror law that the greatest blurring of traditional legal boundaries has taken place. For much of its 70-year history, Liberty NCCL has argued against a special regime of terror as opposed to ordinary criminal law. Why, we argued, should a crime motivated by politics be treated differently from one motivated by greed or simple hate? A crime is a crime is a crime, and the most serious criminal accusation should attract the greatest, and not the least, by way of procedural protection. Liberty's senior citizen status has allowed it to observe the exceptional anti-terror laws pre- and post-Second World War and on into and beyond the Cold War. It has watched the special measures apply to Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. It has watched temporary measures become permanent and what Helena Kennedy calls the contagion of compromises to fair trial rights infect the wider legal system. Up until 2001, however, and one includes in this analysis the extremely sweeping Terrorism Act of 2000, which permanently replaced the old Prevention of Terrorism Act, anti-terror law in this country did at least bear some semblance of criminal law. It might be categorised as a mutated form of that law, extended periods of pre-charge detention, broadly cast offences with reverse burdens of proof, prescription of organisations by the Home Secretary, incitement to terrorism abroad, and so on. However, ultimately, it was all vaguely recognisable to the criminal lawyer, who would ultimately defend those falling foul of the legislation in some semblance of a criminal trial, with all the hallmarks of the same: charges, criminal burden, standard of proof, cross-examination of accusers, and so on. However, to some extent, this all changed with the advent of Part 4 of the Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Act 2001, the emergency legislation that followed the horrific events of September the 11th. When something truly terrible happens, and in particular when innocents are killed and people feel afraid, an understandable cry goes out to the government of the day to act. More often than not, this means the Home Secretary. It must indeed have been a terrible emotional and practical burden to be the incumbent of that great office of state in the autumn of 2001. The obvious temptation, almost the modern tradition, would have been to legislate. Yet how to act, to legislate, when just the previous year your own government passed the toughest and most comprehensive anti-terror law of modern times, the Terrorism Act 2000? To complete the dilemma, how do you act when your government's own precious Human Rights Act has been in force for just under a year? The answer for David Blunkett was to derogate from human rights, or as Connor has put it so colourfully elsewhere, to dream the impossible dream and find the self-destruct button, conveniently located in any Home Secretary's human rights starter pack. In so doing, the Home Secretary and his advisers also dealt with a human rights inconvenience of at least 5 years' standing, namely, the obligation not to deport even suspected terrorists to face torture in their country of nationality. This was the ruling of the European Court of Human Rights in the case of Chahal against the UK in 1996. Mr. Chahal had lived in the UK for many years, but remained an Indian national subject to immigration control. He was suspected of involvement with terrorism in the Punjab and faced deportation by the then Conservative Home Secretary on national security grounds. By 1996, in our pre-Human Rights Act framework of administrative law, immigrants facing deportation, particularly to potential ill treatment, enjoyed a right to some semblance of fairness and to a statutory appeal process. This was not the case, however, in national security cases. Further, under our traditional administrative law, the executive had only to wave the flag of national security when faced with judicial review to effectively oust any real scrutiny of its decision-making. So Mr. Chahal's domestic law challenges were doomed to failure, and the Court of Human Rights found that he had been denied an effective remedy for the vindication of his convention rights under Article 13. It also found that his extensive detention for a total of 6 years pending deportation without recourse to an appropriate court breached his rights against arbitrary detention under Article 5. Crucially, as I've said, it found that to deport a person to a jurisdiction where they could face torture would constitute a breach on the UK's own part of the sacred Article 3 of the Convention, the absolute prohibition of inhuman and degrading treatment and torture. This was a very important decision for all those who believe in the sanctity of human life and human rights everywhere. It would require very serious thought and implementation by a government of either persuasion. As it happened, the task fell to the new Labour government in 1997. Now, the first plank of implementation required no legislation, and certainly none beyond the imminent Human Rights Act. From henceforward, people should not be deported from the UK to face torture elsewhere. Common sense dictates that this must have been a perennial embarrassment to the UK in its dealings with friendly, but non-human rights friendly, governments around the world, who crush dissent and indeed foster terrorism in their own jurisdictions, and were, no doubt are, incredulous at both the common law and international human rights protections granted to those asylum seekers to the UK. Other aspects of the judgment did require legislation. The Special Immigration Appeals Commission Act of 1997, which I worked on as a junior Home Office lawyer, was an attempt to compromise the competing demands of national security and natural justice in an administrative deportation setting. The process involves closed and open parts to cater for much of the relevant material being of a secret intelligence nature. The subject and his lawyers, with their professional duties to him, are excluded from the secret parts and the secret intelligence. At such times, the intelligence may be probed and tested by a vetted special advocate who has no relationship with the subject and may, of course, not divulge the nature of the secrets to him. It was always going to be an imperfect process, but immigration appeals had never attracted the Rolls-Royce due process rights reserved for the criminal justice system. It was designed to give a deportation appeal to people who previously had nothing. It was not originally intended, nor was it ever capable of being, a substitute for a criminal trial in the context of serious terror charges and a possible lifetime of incarceration. In the wake of September the 11th, the so-called Chahal problem was returned to by Whitehall. However, the problem remained that Article 3, the prohibition on torture, is an absolute and non-derogable right, even in times of perceived or actual national emergency. Further, in contrast with the rights responsibilities approach discussed earlier, a fundamental human rights framework accords this protection of basic human dignity even to the most wretched in our world, including terrorist suspects. However, with the creative genius reserved for those looking for legal loopholes, the following thought was born. It may not be possible to derogate from the prohibition against torture, but the right against arbitrary detention under Article 5 of the Convention may be derogated from under Article 15 in time of war or other public emergency threatening the life of the nation, and if the measures consequently adopted derogate only to the extent strictly required by the situation. So, in respect of foreign nationals suspected of links loosely defined, with terrorism or terrorist groups, and who may not be deported because of the prohibition on torture, the government, in a chilling moral mirror of the law-free zone that is Guantanamo Bay, would employ indefinite detention without trial instead. It would do so by amending immigration rather than criminal justice or even conventional anti-terror legislation. A thin veneer of procedural fairness would be provided by access to the secret Special Immigration Appeals Commission, or SIAC, whose jurisdiction would be limited to assessing the reasonableness of the Home Secretary's suspicion. A suspicion which at its lowest might amount to no more than suspicion of links to other suspicious people. Meanwhile, British nationals, for the time being at least, retained our right to a conventional criminal trial in the event that we were accused of links to terrorism. In discussing this crucial derogation from fundamental rights with the Parliamentary Labour Party in the autumn of 2001, the Home Secretary specifically remarked that he was not responding to intelligence of a specific threat, but declaring, and I quote, a technical state of emergency for the purposes of derogating from the ECHR. However, importantly, the government chose not to derogate from Article 14 of the Convention, which prohibits discrimination in the context of other rights. How could the principle of equal treatment be squared with the policy? In finding the derogation unlawful, SIAC itself found discrimination as between British nationals and this class of foreigners. Both classes are capable of being terrorist suspects. In relation to both, there may be insufficient or insufficient admissible evidence to mount a criminal prosecution. Neither category may be deported. Members of the former group, however, continue to live their lives at liberty. The latter potentially face a lifetime's incarceration with no knowledge of the charge or charges against them. The Court of Appeal disagreed with SIAC. This is not discrimination at all, we were told. Like has not been compared with like. Crucially, the detainees, unlike British terror suspects, have no right to remain in the United Kingdom. But surely, this is no more than a description of the badge of discrimination, in this case, nationality. Is it not unlike refuting an allegation of sex discrimination with the claim that she is, after all, just a woman? It would seem that in a Britain where asylum seekers are viewed as almost subhuman, and in a climate of fear of terrorism, even the courts may be slow to their defence. In a further twist in this tale of terror law, last autumn, SIAC upheld reasonable suspicion and detention in the first 10 appeals. However, even more chillingly, the moral connection with Guantanamo Bay was made real. In the course of argument, it had emerged that some of the secret intelligence relied upon by the government had been obtained by oppression or torture at Camp X-Ray and around the world. Rather than deploring such a possibility, SIAC ruled in favour of the government on the following points. The Home Secretary is not bound to close his mind to material which may have been obtained by torture. SIAC is similarly able to look at this material in vindicating suspicion. It is all a matter of weight and degree. Finally, where any issue of torture arises, the burden of proof is on the detainee, who lacks sight of the secret material against him. The legality of this entire policy awaits consideration by the House of Lords Judicial Committee. It is said that this may not be possible before October of this year, when 14 detainees, all asylum seekers, some torture victims, will have been detained without trial for nearly 3 years. Gareth Pearce, who represents most of the detainees, speaks poignantly of the effect of such unending injustice upon the human psyche. She knows of the nightmares built on searching for answers and of the debilitating descent into mental illness. Meanwhile, the Privy Council Committee set up under the 2001 Act to review its operation has reported that internment and the consequent derogation should end, and both Houses of Parliament will debate the matter on the 25th of this month, next week. Now, Liberty has spoken often of this policy over the last 2 years. It has spoken of the ease with which vulnerable minorities may be the first target of exceptional powers, which over time gain currency and acceptability until those in power become rather more ambitious. However, even I did not expect such prophecy to be made good so soon. A few weeks ago, whilst on a foreign visit, Mr. Blunkett took his thinking about the inadequacies of traditional fair trials to the next level. Secret evidence, closed hearings, vetted judges, and a reduced standard of proof are all now mooted for conventional criminal terror trials. Finally, a more general statutory largesse towards the executive and law enforcement agencies is apparent. Once more, this is best easily, but no means exclusively, demonstrated by anti-terror laws, benign in intention, but capable of wide abuse, as has been the case throughout Liberty's 70-year history. Section 44 of the Terrorism Act 2000 allows a chief constable to designate an area for stop and search without suspicion of criminality as under the ordinary law. This may be done if expedient to preventing terrorism, and the designation may last for up to 28 days. In difficult times, the rationale for such a power may be all too clear. On receipt of clear intelligence that a terrorist incident may be planned in a particular area at a particular time, a rational senior police officer does not wish to wait for reasonable suspicion of a particular person. He understandably wants to cordon off the area in question and subject every person wishing to enter to an outer body and bag search. The level of threat justifies the use of police resource, and those searched feel little injustice. There may be no reasonable suspicion of any individual, but at least every person is treated alike. However, in its largesse towards the police and the executive, Parliament didn't provide for judicial warrant before such designation, such departure from normal police powers as prescribed by the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. Nor did it provide for any parliamentary approval or even public notification. The only check on the senior police officer is the Home Secretary, to whom a designation must be sent and who must confirm or cancel it within 48 hours. In September of last year, Section 44 of the 2000 Act was used to single out peace protesters and prevent them from approaching an arms fair in the Docklands here in London. In the course of the ensuing litigation, which continues, Liberty learned that the Metropolitan Police Commissioner and indeed the Home Office had been making and confirming designations covering the entire Metropolitan Police area on a rolling basis every 28 days since February of 2001, 6 months before September the 11th. To the best of my knowledge, though there is really no way of knowing for sure at any time, the whole of London remains an area where there may be stop and search without suspicion, with all the consequent potential for abuse. So what's so wrong with the Blair Blunkett vision of how to deliver freedom from fear? Firstly, it is both over-selective and simplistic in its view of those worthy of generosity. In reality, perpetrators of crime may also be victims. Everybody's children are basically good kids, and the persecuted person to whom aid should be sent and in whose name wars may be fought is no less worthy of compassion and dignity when he arrives on our doorstep. Secondly, it is ineffective in meeting its own objectives. The aspiration most proclaimed in relation to the Bleak Council estate is that it should be transformed from a group of unhappy individuals and families into a safer or safe community. Yet crime is not solved, nor community built, on such crude and authoritarian a foundation as criminal legislation. You do not reduce crime by categorising yet more human misery as criminal behaviour. Thirdly, it may be positively counterproductive. To continually compromise notions of fair treatment is not merely to offend lawyers' delicate sensibilities. Fairness runs deeper into our basic humanity than that. So persistently to denigrate fair process is to create apparent and actual injustice. There is nothing like a sense of injustice to turn people away from a stake in a community and indeed perhaps from democracy itself. This was the lesson of internment in Northern Ireland. This must not become the tragic lesson of the criminalised children on the Blair Blunkett Council estate or of the various injustices done in the war against terror. Fourthly, just as the thinking learns insufficiently from the lessons of history, it fails to approach the future with sufficient caution. It stands in grave danger of leaving in its wake a constitutional poverty, a trust in the executive, a raft of sweeping legislation to be used or abused by accident or design, by future governments of differing motives and persuasions. It fails to remember that democracy is more than mere majority rule, that the rule of law and respect for inalienable human rights distinguish democracy from the rule of the mob. This was recognised by a previous generation that knew much of the horrors and terrors of war. It should not be forgotten now. The thinking lacks regard for the need to protect vulnerable minorities, including asylum seekers, who cannot rightly be blamed for their vulnerability to the mob. It is quite right, of course, that human rights belong to all of us, including the victim of crime and the elderly relative in the care home. However, the ultimate litmus of both democracy and human rights lies in the treatment of the most unpopular members of society. This is a standard from which those who believe in freedom cannot flinch. What then is liberty's role in the future development and settlement of these questions? Too much resting on its history, too much enjoyment of its birthday. These are not options. The voice of liberty must be both old and wise and young and dynamic. It must burst with compassion and reason. It must find its way to the heart of the Blair Blunkett estate and make relevant a notion of human rights of which no human being may ever be stripped. This was ever the dream. This remains the possibility. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Shannon, for a fantastic, riveting talk. I don't know about this intellectual wing of liberty. I think it's in your office, actually. I don't think it's here at the LSE at all. So I'm sure that that will have provoked questions from a lot of you. There are a lot of you here. So Tommy's going to take some questions. I might take on her behalf sort of a few to start. Can you please remember just a few things? One, give your name, please, if you feel you can, and also an organisation of where you're from, because it does help us to connect with the question. Secondly, if you could keep it relatively short, it could be an observation, but mainly short. And thirdly, do wait till the microphone arrives. Sometimes the great questions are uttered, but people can't hear them, and then it's too late. So I wonder whether we have any questions to start us off here. We have a gentleman at the back on the right-hand side who's got the advantage of being beside a microphone. Sir.
thank you for a very clear criticism of the climate of human rights in this country. As we appear to be somewhat deficient...
Do you want to just say who you are, sir, very briefly? Or do you prefer not to?
Ray Jackson, ex-LSE.
Thank you.
As we appear to be rather deficient in a number of these fields, I wonder if the speaker would care to mention which state or society more nearly meets these ideals, or perhaps mention one or two names. Thank you.
Thank you. Perhaps, Shami, I'll take one or two others, if I may. Do we have anybody else? Madam, here in the centre aisle. Just wait for the...
I was very moved and found what you said. My name is Jocelyn Watson. I used to be the black lesbian caseworker at Lesbian and Gay Employment Rights. I was, as I said, very moved by what you had to say. I thought it was very insightful, and it was a damning indictment of the Blair government. What I am particularly interested in is what perspective you have in terms of the future. I mean, 6 million people took to the streets in opposition to this war. 600 cities around the world saw their voices being unheard. How do you foresee the future in terms of actually taking our struggle for human rights into the domain globally?
Thank you. I'll take a couple more. I've got a gentleman here and then a gentleman at the back, and we'll then hear Shami for the first time in response. Sir, with your name. And
thank you, Chair. Martin Green, Labour Party member, personal capacity. Would there be, do you believe, more freedom than in Blair's Britain with the change of Prime Minister? Thank you.
Thank you, Martin, addressing you now in your personal capacity. The gentleman at the back.
Hello, my name is Vincenzo Rampulla. You talked about the notion of human rights on Blair and Blunkett's estate. Do you think that the level of teaching of human rights within our schools and educational institutions is adequate?
Thank you all for your succinctness. Show me.
Which society would be better? I wasn't quite sure where you were going with that, but maybe it was one of those, well, you seem to find it all pretty miserable here. Where would you like a ticket? I don't know, and I wouldn't like to suggest that, I mean, these are challenges facing all Western democracies, and I know that I was slightly bleak and unashamedly critical of the government. I don't feel qualified to comment on whether other people are in a more advanced state of their development. But I will point out, and I didn't point out in the talk, that in relation to the derogation from Article 5 of the Convention and this choice, this very definite policy choice that the Home Secretary took to detain people without trial, and all the criticisms I've made of that, we are, in this country, the only Council of Europe country to have made that choice. And I think that as a government that is at times avowedly pro-European, and as indeed the government that incorporated to some extent the Convention of Human Rights into English law, that is food for thought. And other European countries have not found it necessary to derogate from rights in that way. The future globally, goodness me, 6 million people and... I think the globe is a little big for my ambitions, but I am, despite how it may have sounded, I'm not actually bleak about the future. The 6 million people that took to the streets for their beliefs actually fills a campaigner with some hope. People are not apolitical. They may be turned off with party politics, but they are not apolitical. They are prepared to act on what they believe. If political parties aren't matching their aspirations, then they will take to the streets. And it's really, I suppose, got to be the ambition of those of us who care about human rights to get people excited about human rights domestically. And you know, I'm ashamed of myself that when the government was supposedly nearly brought down the other week, it was tuition fees, an important issue, particularly in a place like this, but it wasn't internment. And I say that not just to beat myself up, but because I think that if more people knew, more people would care, and that people are basically good and compassionate for their fellow human beings, and that this analysis that is offered of the Blair Blunkett council estate is essentially so pessimistic about human beings and about their worth and about their ambitions and about their dignity and about their respect for each other. And that's why I differ from it. Change of Prime Minister. Well, I mean, I think it's right in a way that this talk was Blair's Britain, because I think poor old Mr. Blunkett is often sort of held up as the kind of, you know, the Aunt Sally or the Uncle Dave or whatever, and he is the bad guy who's doing all these terrible things in the Home Office. I think we have to realise that he doesn't do these things by himself. As to whether a different Prime Minister would have a different approach, I mean, it is wrong to suggest that personality doesn't have some bearing on these very crucial decisions. I think I learnt that as a civil servant, that so much of politics is actually about personality. Everything that they said wasn't the case. But that being said, if people like us don't improve the currency of this message, then we're in danger of not doing any better with the next Prime Minister. Teaching of human rights in schools. I know it now goes on. I visited once the DfE website, and it was good to find human rights in the citizenship module in a module of citizenship education. But I was deeply concerned about this rights responsibility stuff. Now, that's not because I don't believe in responsibility, in social and civic responsibility. I was a public servant, and now I do this saving the world stuff. Okay, so I do care about responsibilities, but I'm really, really disappointed that even in the materials that I've seen in relation to human rights teaching in schools, there is this kind of quid pro quo rights responsibilities approach that doesn't ultimately face the truth that there are people who may have done terrible things or may be accused of doing terrible things, but they are still human beings, and we measure ourselves by the way that we treat them.
Thanks, Shami. Should we take some more? There was a gentleman who had his hand up here.
My name is Michael Honey. I'm not representing anybody, really. The talk we've had tonight brilliantly sets out the evidence that the cause for human rights and freedom is on the retreat. And my question is, why should it be on the retreat at a time when historically we are safer than we have ever been? I've spent all my life under the threat of nuclear warfare, and for the last 10 years I've felt that lifted off me. I feel that my children don't have that fear. But somehow or other, we've allowed people to replace that fear, which was very real, with an entirely mythical fear, this so-called war on terror. What terror? How many people have actually died by so-called terrorist activities, which have given rise to the kind of repression which we're seeing now? Is it not part of civil liberty, of liberty's remit, to draw attention to the fact that this is a dangerous myth which is being allowed to be perpetrated, and people being encouraged to be frightened, something which people are easily encouraged to do, by a quite illusory threat, which in actual practice, even where it is successful, is like a pinprick to the kind of civilization that we belong to.
Thank you. There was a gentleman right in the back whose hand is now up. I wonder whether we want to broaden the gender basis of the question. And we have a lady just afterwards in the front row here, sir.
Realistically, when we look at...
Can we just remind ourselves of who you are? Sorry to be so...
Sorry, G. Leslie. Realistically, when we look at the measures already in place, be it the European arrest warrants, the two terrorism acts, etc., what, if any of those, can be reversed in any way? And when we look at future measures, such as changes to immigration, asylum, and identity cards, which, if any of those, do we realistically think can be opposed so that they don't come into full force? What is the likely situation, and what can we as individuals, organisations, do to best oppose the assault on freedom?
Thank you. And perhaps one more before your response. Madam on the front there, you got the microphone? Good.
Hello, Julia Crossfield, LSE. Actually, the gentleman downstairs asked my question. It was about identity cards and what you thought about those.
Thank you.
Well, shall we take the easy one first? What do I think about identity cards? I'm a Ginnam. Liberty has consistently opposed identity cards, not because we want to be difficult and we want to rain on the Home Secretary's big idea in his parade, though it's not a new idea. It was once mooted by a previous Home Secretary, now a great Liberal leader of the Conservative Party. But we oppose identity cards, firstly because the case for them has not been made out, and it is incumbent upon the government to make out the case for identity cards, which would mark such a constitutional sea change in individuals' relationship with the state. And despite all this other stuff that's happening, it really would mark a sea change to have to answer to the state for your identity. And that is a presumption that could be rebutted, but I have never heard the evidence or the argument, the rational argument, for how it is an ID card would make me safer, happier, and so on. Further, we at Liberty think that there are insufficient protections of personal privacy in this country, and an ID card, a single ID card with all sorts of potential information on it would create an even further opportunity for interferences with informational privacy. And I have to say personally, from my point of view, I'm very concerned about the implications for race relations in this country. The evidence from all other countries with ID cards shows beyond doubt that ID cards are a further tool that the police may use to hassle principally young black men. And recent TV documentaries, even some years after Stephen Lawrence's death, show that the police have a long way to go before ID cards are safe in their hands. What can be reversed in the various draconian measures I've referred to, and what can be defeated in the near future? I do believe that internment can be ended, and it can be ended if enough of us know about it, care about it. I think it is not unremarkable that a committee of privy councillors, including such noted progressives and radicals as Dr. Brian Mulwinney, and Connor knows this because we gave evidence together, Dr. Brian Mulwinney and Tony Newton, a former Conservative cabinet minister, have said that internment should end. It is not unremarkable that the Archbishop of Canterbury at Christmas compared internment at Belmarsh to Guantanamo Bay and said that both policies should end in their victimisation of Muslims and the injustice that I discussed before. I think that this can be won if enough people make enough noise about it, and I'm in the business of making noise. In terms of new measures on the horizon, I've referred to this awful, awful, illiberal, inhuman asylum bill that's currently going through Parliament. It is a terrible bill. I used to work on terrible, terrible legislation, and this is even more terrible. It is a very thin bill. I think you'd be hard put to find a good governance measure in it. It's legislation as the highest and lowest form of spin. But there are two parts of it that are particularly awful. One is the forced destitution of failed asylum seekers, including those with children, with the consequent likelihood that their children may be removed from them and taken into care. And the second really awful measure is a complete ouster of all judicial review and access to the higher courts. And I think that there is some room for movement in relation to both of those clauses of a terrible piece of legislation. So I think that, again, pressure, lobbying, noise, letters to the MP, letters to the newspapers, are all still worthy of pursuit. The mythical fear question. I don't actually want to refer to terrorism as a mythical fear, because I think it's a very real fear. But I think that it has to be placed, I think the way I'd respond to your contribution is to place it alongside other constant and very real fears in modern society and throughout history. And I rather agree with you about the need to compare the current threat with previous threats. There is this lack of history, this lack of memory, as if no one's ever been through difficult times before, no one's ever been afraid before, no one's ever been in danger before. Because I remember as a child worrying about the nuclear threat and so on. And of course, as I say, the drafters of the post-war human rights instruments knew very, very well about fear and about war and about terror. I don't think it's a mythical fear, but I think that there has been a tendency always to seize upon new fear and not to lead people out of it, and to play to the lowest common denominator rather than to lead people and to deal with their fears and rationalise them and set them in context. And I think that one of the problems that we face, and that we have faced notwithstanding this wonderful Human Rights Act that's sitting on a shelf somewhat tarnished at times, is that there's been no real leadership, both in relation to embedding these values into wider society and in relation to saying, no, we're not tough on asylum seekers just because this is a way of fending off the BNP. We meet the BNP and its paucity of argument head on. So I think leadership is the answer to addressing all of these legitimate fears. I don't think any of them are mythical, they just need to be placed in context.
Might have time for two or three more. I wonder whether there's anybody who'd like to contribute. I think, sir, we may have heard from you. Is there anybody, madam? Yes, thank you.
My name is Almas and I'm a student at the LSE. I very much appreciated your thoughts and your talk. And I know that it was focused on the UK context. I'm wondering what, there seem to be similar patterns emerging in the US. You mentioned Guantanamo Bay as an example, but there are patterns of internment and representations of race and culture similar in US media and in sort of discursive practice. And I'm wondering if there are patterns that we can talk about between the UK and the US, if we should have sort of similar concerns in how representation is taking place, and what we can say about the undermining of civil liberties and human rights between these two states, and if the United States has a particularly important role, or if there should be a discussion about the US in particular in this discussion. Thank you.
There are a number of hands up. I'll take this gentleman on this side, who's now reaching for the microphone, and then I think there was a gentleman over here, and then we'll have to finish.
Joel Kenrick, LSE, and one of the peace protesters who was stopped and searched under the terrorist act earlier on this year. My question, though, is about the GCHQ whistleblower who's coming up for trial. I'm just wondering what your views are on that issue.
Thank you. And finally, there was somebody perhaps who's now withdrawn their hand.
Here,
just here. Just here, this gentleman here who hasn't spoken. We do try and spread it from meeting to meeting. Thank you, sir.
Hi, Andrew Willett from Bates, Wells and Braithwaite Solicitors. You illustrated the almost systematic clampdown on civil liberties, but at the same time I feel there's quite a strong element of reactionary and ad hoc measures from the government to headlines. And I think any government would probably be under the same pressures and perhaps react the same way. So I'm wondering if there's any other measure that we could have in place to safeguard the system, such as perhaps the impact of a written constitution, both legally and culturally, and safeguarding human rights.
Thank you very much.
What do I think about Catherine Gunn?
Well, Liberty, of course, represents Catherine Gunn. So it'll be no surprise to you that I think, having met her, that she is a wonderful and brave woman. And she's not unlike many of my my friends who are serving civil servants or former civil servants. She's a quiet, mild-mannered person who was a public servant and acted according to her conscience. And I think that it's absolute madness that the Attorney General, whose personal decision it must have been, has thought it sensible to consent to her prosecution. That's what I think about Catherine Gunn. The relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States, I think that Connor should have a whole evening devoted just to this subject, because it is particularly interesting in the human rights context, and indeed in the specific context of the shoulder-to-shoulder relationship in the war against terror. Helena Kennedy referred to Part 4 of the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act in her Hamlin lecture of December of 2001 as an unholy pact with the United States, a deliberate replica of Guantanamo Bay. I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but there are clearly close similarities. It's easier to go for foreigners. You go for foreigners, your own citizens have residual rights. I've always had a love-hate relationship with the United States myself, as a like Jimmy Porter in Look Back in Anger, this idea that you grow up in Britain post-war and perhaps all our children will be American, and you know, you kind of grow up on Batman and Cagney and Lacey, and you go to the LSE and you watch Woody Allen movies. but also a love-hate relationship, because on the one hand one looks to this, and the final question you talked about constitutional protections, when one looks at America as a law student or a human rights lawyer with some jealousy of, you know, a Bill of Rights and a constitutional culture and American movies where people quote the Bill of Rights at each other, and yet the orange uniforms and the oppression that is clearly going on in Guantanamo Bay. So it's a very complicated relationship. On a more optimistic note, I note that local people around America are passing their own resolutions in their states and in their, I don't know, parish council equivalents, rejecting the Patriot Act and rejecting various oppressive measures. And maybe that's something that we campaigners in the UK could learn from. Ad hoc measures that any government would, well, I think, you know, you're so right, the guy from Bateswells and Braithwaite, as a former Home Office civil servant, I should be careful because I have former colleagues in the room who I have spotted. They may have spotted me, but I've spotted them too. I think that they would agree that, you know, a mild-mannered civil servant dreads the conference season, and in particular perhaps dreads the Breakfast with Frost programme and the Prime Minister's interview before his big conference speech. What will he say? What will be on the statute book next week? I think you're right to suggest it isn't just about Blair's Britain. As I suggested, there's a continual trend and a constant temptation to respond to, you know, to turn the soundbite into the next bill. Whether further legislation or embedded constitutional protection is the answer, I don't know. I think we have to look to build this idea from the bottom up, from culture upwards. I don't necessarily think that the answer to, I mean, look at the United States. The answer cannot be as simple as further constitutional provision.
Thank you, Charlie. I have to say, a talk that was quite riveting and exceeded only in its quality, if that were possible, by your responses to those various questions, which were cumulatively quite brilliant. I have to say the Britain you described is kind of unrecognisable at times, frightening, even compared to when we thought things were bad in the 1980s. But at least we know that liberty is in this very good condition to have such an amazing leader. And also, she rightly emphasised the importance of civil society and approached it optimistically. And in terms of making moral noise, I think we should note with pride that the LSE has just started the first, I'm told, university chapter of Liberty, which has been up and running for about a month. And I wonder, is Tim Cook-Hurl, who calls himself the chair, is he present where he can stand up? No? He's not at the meeting of his leader. Is he here?
There you are. Stand up, Tim. There are apparently 75 members, and he'll be at the drinks afterwards, I'm sure, won't you, Tim? And it's actually a small way in which people at the LSE could contribute tonight in terms of getting involved and in providing the support for the moral noise that makes civil society... To sit down, Tim, don't get carried away. can actually help with this task. We can all do things. That's a lesson I took from tonight's talk. Three very small points. Katarina Tomaszewski's lecture, lunchtime lecture on education, has had to be shifted next week. We're all on strike here for investment in higher level education, we call it. Pay when we're at home. And it's now on Thursday at the 26th of February at 12:45 p.m. And we have Helena Kennedy coming here on International Women's Day. Our next big talk is Helena chaired by Lady Hale. So we have a throughput and a consistency in our perspective on rights this academic year, and we're delighted about that. We also will be able to continue this conversation over drinks in the Robinson Room on the third floor, and Shami's coming up for a drink, and you're all extremely welcome to come for a drink. But can we end by reverting back to the person who's made this such an exceptional evening and thanking her for the care with which she spoke? Thank you.